content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and AAA Go magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Historic sites are always available when you travel, even if it's close to home. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to feature some articles that spotlight historic settings. Our first stop is featured in a News and Observer article, Historic Raleigh Home Coming Down, One Piece at a Time. It's written by Martha Quillen and appeared in the October 26, 2020 issue. Residents along White Oak Road in Raleigh have noticed a lot of people coming and going lately from what many know as the historic Broughton House. I've seen them walking out of there with their arms full of stuff, said Wilson Heyman, who lives next door. It looked like they were having a garage sale or something. The garage is in fact for sale, along with every other room in the 3,446-square-foot house, and each of their architectural and structural pieces and parts. In an unusual liquidation sale, the home is being auctioned off and disassembled the way it was built in 1938, one piece at a time. Whatever is left, after salvagers have come with their hammers and pry bars, reciprocating saws and shovels, will be bulldozed and hauled away. In late October or early November, the lot will be cleared, and the nearly 3 acres the Broughton House once commanded will become 4 home sites in one of Raleigh's most prestigious Inside the Beltline neighborhoods. It's a beautiful home, or it was at one time, said Heyman, who can see the 2-story house from his. While known now simply as the White Oak Road section of Raleigh, the area where Irving F. Hall and his wife Olive bought land in 1936 to build a home is in the Anderson Heights area of town. The couple bought 10 contiguous lots that wrap around a high hill and a sharp curve on White Oak Road. They situated their house and porticoshare across the 3 lots that occupy the highest point. Hall was the president of State Capital Life Insurance Company. The colonial revival-style home would have been well-suited for entertaining corporate executives and potential clients who would have crossed the deep, slate-tiled front porch with its 6 columns and its treetop view on their way to the front door. They might have noticed the marble tiles on the floor of the wide foyer that spread into the dining room and been intrigued by the gentle twist of the staircase to the 2nd floor. They might have had drinks in the living room or been invited for a smoke in the dark-paneled library or the enclosed back porch, but they probably weren't allowed into the small kitchen or into the 3 upstairs bedrooms, each with its own bath. The plainly dressed basement rooms, including a small den with a fireplace, were almost certainly off-limits to casual visitors. The home changes hands. The Halls sold the home in 1950, to a physician, and it changed hands again in 1960 before finally being purchased by Robert Bain Broughton and his then-wife, Celeste, in the fall of 1965. Broughton was a son of J. Melville Broughton, a former United States Senator and Governor of North Carolina from 1941 to 1945. The couple later divorced, and Celeste Broughton stayed in the home with her 2 sons. A bankruptcy court approved the sale of the home in June 2019 to pay debts, and it was sold at auction to a Carey couple, Anuj and Vinita Mittal, in October of that year. While some neighbors and preservationists hoped the house would be rehabilitated, Johnny Chappell of Chappell Residential Incorporated in Raleigh, who is marketing property for the Mittal, said the buyer who chose the land where the house stands wants it taken down. The original lots have been recombined to create a total of 4 new home sites. Each new site will be about 3/4 of an acre, Chappell said. As of Thursday, 2 have sold. The properties were listed at $900,000 to $1.1 million each, Chappell said. Chappell is not involved in the salvaging of materials from the home. That's being overseen by Barbara Dillard, who said she has decades of experience working with antiques. Earlier in the week, Dillard picked through molded copies of Nancy Drew books and stacks of legal filings, bags filled with clothing, and cabinets still stocked with toiletries to sort trash from sellable items. By appointment, Dillard allows interested salvagers to visit the house and bid on elements they would like to remove. We don't want anything to go to waste. Bits of paper with handwritten bids are taped to the solid pine doors. Someone has claimed a window here, a cabinet there. One person wants the marble tiles from the dining room. Another has dibs on the slate from the porch. We're trying to reuse or recycle every bit of this that we possibly can, Dillard said, pulling a set of glass candle holders from a box in the basement. We don't want anything to go to waste that doesn't have to. Myrick Howard, president of Preservation North Carolina, said he hated to hear that the house will be sold as salvage, a process seen as an absolute last resort by preservationists because, like archaeological finds, the elements of a historic home lose their significance once removed from the context of the house they comprised. Heyman, the neighbor, feels the same way. It's a piece of our past that will be disappearing, he said. I'm very sad about that. So kind of an interesting story there on White Oak Road in Raleigh. We're going to go out of town for the next one, going west to the town of Hillsboro, where writer Tammy Grubb reports Hillsboro's historic Colonial Inn is renovated and reopening this month. Her article appeared in the October 21st, 2020 issue of the News and Observer. A historic inn, once feared lost to neglect and time, will reopen its doors to guests next month in downtown Hillsboro, and she's obviously referring to now November. Reservations are being taken now for weddings and other events at the Colonial Inn at 153 West King Street, co-owner Justin Fishfar said. General manager Elise Tyler is planning for a grand opening in November. So many people have shared a story about the 182-year-old inn or special connection to it since they bought the property 2 years ago, Tyler said. We want that to be the memories they can have again, she said. It's such a special place, and it has such a special place in so many people's hearts for all these different reasons. The 10,000-square-foot two-story inn was built in 1838 as the Orange Hotel to serve boarders and travelers conducting business in the county seat of Hillsboro. It passed through several owners and names, Strayhorn's Hotel, Okanichi Hotel, Corbinton Inn, before being dubbed the Colonial Inn in 1924. From there, it expanded and prospered, adding a restaurant in the 1940s that attracted people from near and far. 17 years of neglect. But in 2001, the inn was closed and sold at auction to Chapel Hill businessman Francis Henry for $440,000. What followed was 17 years of neglect, as Henry bickered with the town over how to save the inn and then sought to tear it down. By 2018, the town had begun eminent domain proceedings when a group of investors stepped forward. They paid Henry $880,000 for the property, with plans to seek state and federal tax credits for the work. Since then, the inn's kitchen has been demolished and its former dining room gutted to the foundation. Many of the ancient beams, some of which had cracked, have been braced, says Fishfar, a partner in Allied DevCorp, LLC, which owns the inn. Once we got it uncovered, it was like holy smokes, Fishfar said. It was a lot of ad-libbing as we were going through figuring out where the problems are and addressing them as we came across them. They drafted 9 different plans before finding the right one. In the end, the project cost $2.9 million, about 15% over budget, but turned out almost exactly as we envisioned it, he said. The inn is not perfect. The floor slopes in places, and at least one door frame is out of square, but it is what it is. It's the character of the building, Tyler said. It's moved and changed over so many years, it predates all of us. I very much hope it will outlive all of us, she said. Renovating the inn. The first step was uncovering the bones, from massive oak beams to exposed brick fireplaces and a stone support that may date to the original tavern built in the 1700s. A window frame and other parts of the cabin also remain part of the inn, Tyler said. A pair of narrow wooden doors welcome guests at the center of a rough flagstone porch lined with 10 pairs of tall white columns. The second-story balcony lining the front facade catches the breeze and offers guests a memorable view of West King Street. The bones remain true, but they're now clothed in velour, comfort, and a touch of glam. The lobby and the bar, the oldest sections, hug a central staircase that, despite its age, only has one step that creaks. The seating options are intimate, from custom-made navy blue booths to deep-seated wingback chairs. The front desk and the bar are handcrafted from reclaimed wood, and the brass bar top will weather as it is exposed to the oil in customers' hands and the acidity in their drinks, Tyler said. Gone is the patriotic wallpaper and the colonial-style lighting, replaced by a grand ballroom with marble floors and a signature chandelier featuring crystal-encrusted wedding bands. In other rooms, lights sparkle through teardrop crystals, opaque panels, and curvaceous gold pendants. Just off the ballroom floor is one of two kitchens outfitted for caterers and special event staff. The Inn will offer ticket-only Sunday brunches and Thursday dinners, Tyler said, with food based on the 1972 Colonial Inn cookbook. Another kitchen and several guest rooms lie upstairs, including a luxury honeymoon suite with a heated jacuzzi. A stone patio links the Inn to a new guest wing with 22 more rooms and a lush lawn for weddings, parties, and friendly gatherings. The transformation continues to slow onlookers along King Street, Tyler said. There's just something magnetic about this building, she said. It just pulls you in, and I am not any different. I looked in the window just like everybody else. Business, art partnerships. None of the owners who hail from other places had a connection with the Inn, Tyler said, but they share a vision for its future and for its role in downtown Hillsboro. They've reached out to nearby restaurants, retailers, and service providers about offering guest experiences. Whether it's a yoga class or a manicure and a glass of wine, or coupons that can introduce visitors to a business they might not have considered. A phone booth near the Inn's front door will become a rotating display cabinet promoting a variety of businesses. Veshvar compared the ambiance they want to the second-story porches and front stoops in New Orleans. Instead of being a dark street once you get past Nomad, a restaurant, I think that whole block is really just going to come alive, Veshvar said. An art initiative also will showcase Hillsboro's creative side. They work with the Hillsboro Arts Council to select the first 35 artists whose works will be featured and for sale at the Inn, Tyler said. It's just a way that we can allow people who are traveling to see the Inn or to see the art and enjoy it as their first look at Hillsboro. And plus, we get beautiful wall decorations and something that's always changing and interesting. So you always have a reason to come back, Tyra said. For younger visitors, the Inn's employees are painting small wooden cars reminiscent of the nearby Okanichi Speedway. The cars will be hidden around the property, and smaller versions will be available for the children to take home as souvenirs, she said. We want that connection. We're putting all of these things in place to really let people know we care about you, and we really think that this is the heartbeat of Hillsboro, Tyler said. We just want to embody as much as possible and partner with as many people as we can in order to make it evident that that's what we're here to do. Well, perhaps one of the best-known historic travel destinations is the French capital, Paris. If you were to ask what would be one of the best-known tourist sites there, well, no doubt the Eiffel Tower would be among the responses. In the October 16, 2020 issue of the News and Observer, we find a story about a replica of the Eiffel Tower made with wine corks. It's found in one of America's most celebrated historic cities, Philadelphia. Writer Grace Dickinson of the Philadelphia Inquirer tells us about a 92-year-old who uses wine corks to recreate the Eiffel Tower while battling leukemia. Walter Duschel likes a challenge. At 92 years old, he's out trimming bushes and pulling weeds. He's planting grass seeds, praying for new growth, and on most mornings he's inside his home art studio picking up a paintbrush or sculpting utensil. His latest project, a 7.5-foot-tall Eiffel Tower made entirely out of wine corks. Across 9 months, Duschel used a Swiss Army knife to chisel nearly 2,000 corks into building blocks. It's a meditation he credits with helping him get through not only the pandemic, but a much larger personal challenge. In January 2019, Duschel was diagnosed with leukemia. He never saw it coming, nor would he let it kill his spirit. I've had some breakdowns mentally. Even though I passed 92, you still want to be young, to stay vigorous and productive, says Duschel. But I look at chemo the same way I look at the Eiffel Tower, a challenge I'd overcome. Duschel goes to the doctor for chemotherapy treatments monthly, each time for 4 days in a row. Naturally, he's tired. Most afternoons he spends lying down or taking naps, especially in the days following treatment. But there's rarely a day where he doesn't first spend at least 30 minutes, and usually far longer, working on his art. It helps me generate energy. It requires concentration, and you need to develop energy to concentrate, and that helps me spiritually, says Duschel. His wife, Mary, has talked with his doctor about the Eiffel Tower. They both view it as a form of medicine. It was an extreme help during this time, she says. He's not one to sit around. This gave him purpose, something to look forward to, and that's what you need, especially when you have a health issue. About 10 years ago, Duschel and his wife visited the real Eiffel Tower in Paris. The most memorable part for Duschel was sharing a meal inside its first-floor restaurant, which offers views of the Trocadero Gardens and the Palais de Chaillot. But, he says, the inspiration for his project had little to do with the trip. I have this little replica, maybe 12 inches tall, and I picked it up one day and just said to myself, "This is it," Duschel says. The Eiffel Tower was a real challenge, and I wanted that challenge. Yet another challenge to be conquered. He got to work on the tower in January, drawing rough blueprints, carving corks, and then using Elmer's glue and a few wire rods to put it all together. It took me about 3 tries to come up with the bottom arch, but the hardest part was actually the long tower at the top, because it's all one piece and everything needed to be perfectly uniform to stay level, says Duschel. Lit up on the first level of the tower is a recreation of the restaurant that Duschel remembers most. He calls it the Tiffany Room, complete with 4 miniature Tiffany lamps, as well as little chairs, a table, and a carpet all made from cork. The room overlooks a courtyard filled with 8 miniature street lights, fake green trees, court-crafted benches, and a burgundy-accented plaza that utilizes corks from the red wine bottles. Duschel came to Philadelphia in 1956 from Stuttgart, Germany, to work as a chef for the company that became Aramark. He moved up the ladder, then managed a country club before retiring 25 years ago. He picked up the cork carving hobby in retirement as a way to keep his fidgety hands occupied. In the 15 years since, he's completed dozens of sculptures. The Eiffel Tower stands as his tallest, finished 3 months earlier than expected. It's one of the few upsides of the pandemic, he says. I thought it'd take a full year, but the coronavirus gave me an opportunity to work on it every day, says Duschel. My wife says I have a lot of patience for this, but I lack a bit of patience for everything else. He and his wife have 5 kids combined from previous marriages, but because of the pandemic, they seldom get to see them. Like many their age, they're cautious, living sometimes painstakingly low-key. But we're not afraid, says Duschel. We listen to the doctor, we keep our distance. Once the pandemic dies down, he hopes to share the tower with as many people as possible. His dream is to have it displayed in a museum or somewhere for the public to enjoy. Now that it's finished, I feel relieved, says Duschel. Sometimes I sit there and I'm looking at my creation, and then I'm looking around for the guy who put it together. Great story, huh? Well, to conclude our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to hear from the Washington Post writer Kathy Stevenson. Her article, "Amid the Pandemic, A Writer Finds Inspiration in Century-Old Travel Stories," it appeared in the June 26, 2020 issue of the Washington Post. Several years ago, I was wandering through an outdoor antiques and collectibles fair, and I chanced upon an antiquarian book dealer with tables of books laid out in a tempting display. Before my husband could hustle me safely away, I had purchased an 8-volume set of books called With the World's Greatest Travelers, published in 1901. The pages were intact, if a bit brittle and musty, and although the bindings are now crumbling, the book remains in remarkably good shape. My reason for the purchase made complete sense to me, if no one else. Mainly as a writer and reader, how could I resist such an alluring premise? Or maybe I should say promise, because that's what the books were. A promise to take me to places in the world I knew I would never go. Not only geographically, but also because of the many worlds these first-hand accounts describe no longer exist. Some have been displaced or erased by nature, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, locusts, while others have evolved because of political upheavals and wars. And now, of course, the nature and logistics of travel itself have been turned upside down by the coronavirus pandemic. My satisfaction with my purchase came not only because of the reasonable price, $35, but also because as a writer I envision immersing myself in the accounts of these world's great travelers and coming away with inspiration for my own stories. I have learned over decades of writing to trust my instincts when it comes to sources of inspiration. Sometimes a promising lead turns into a dead end, but more often than not, a quickening of the heartbeat is reason enough to pay attention. What tips for traveling have changed since medieval times? Well, surprisingly few. Indeed, those first few weeks, whenever I had free time, I would open one of the volumes and jump right in. I might end up at Alaska's Muir Glacier in 1890 with Miss Septima M. Collis, who had this to say upon viewing the massive expanse of ice for the first time from aboard a ship of tourists. "I pray heaven that neither age nor infirmity may ever efface from my memory the sight and sensation of that moment." She then goes on to describe, in harrowing detail, her 2.5-mile ascent of a path along the glacier, which she remarked seemed more like 10 miles with a guide. It has been said that persons have been missed and never found who made this ascent. In fact, many of the accounts of travels, no matter where in the world they are, the Arctic seas, Algiers, Brazil, Seville, Spain, Damascus, Syria, are harrowing narratives, filled with wonder, danger, and a sense of the epic. They are often also, when read with today's cultural and historical awareness and sensitivities, both subtly and overtly racist and culturally tone-deaf. But to read lived history is to learn. Who is to say that 100 years from now, our customs, our tweets and blogs of our daily lives, and our language use won't be parsed and found wanting? Some narratives sound as chatty as if they had been written last week, like this small observation by Harriet Beecher Stowe during her trip to Paris in 1853, shortly after the publication of Uncle Tom's Cabin. "In the evening I rested from the day's fatigue by an hour in the garden of the Palais Royal. I sat by one of the little tables and called for an ice. There were hundreds of ladies and gentlemen eating ices, drinking wine, reading the papers, smoking, chatting. Scores of pretty children were frolicking and enjoying the balmy evening," Stowe wrote. But most of the narratives are steeped in danger, whether from nature, native populations who don't take kindly to visitors, sickness, or sheer recklessness. Curiosity may have been at the root of most of the explorations these world travelers undertook, but simple luck was a common thread among the many who survived. What reader or travel enthusiast could resist first-hand narratives with titles like Adventures with Tunisian Bandits, Fugitives from the Arctic Seas, or Mount Etna in Eruption? Several chronicles are relayed by familiar names in history and exploration: Elliot Warburton, Henry M. Stanley, Mungo Park, mostly men. Hopefully, when today's volumes are published, women will be on more equal footing. But at some point in my reading, I had to put aside my own perspective, that of a white woman, age 67 in 2020, and just go with the flow, making note of the prejudices of the age, but also trying to learn and contrast. Maps new and old offer shelter-in-place globetrotting and lessons in human history. Who could fail to be thrilled by the breathless narration of Thebes and its mighty ruins recounted by Warburton? "It was late when we returned to our tents after 14 hours' exposure to the powerful sun of the Thebaid. The prince's boat was just putting off with a parting salute as we dismounted. By the time the last echo of our return guns had died away among the mountains, I was asleep. When the lamps and supper came from the boat, I found the tent was literally swarming with hideous insects, winged centipedes, horned dragonflies, monstrous ants. Livid-looking beetles, moths, and locusts were crawling, as if the butterfly were giving her celebrated ball upon my cloak. They had probably been attracted by the smell of the mummies and the cerements that lay strewn about the tent. When I again fell asleep, I was suddenly awakened by the cold, slimy pat of a bullfrog falling on my cheek. Such are some of the consequences of sleeping among the pharaohs," wrote Warburton. Tales of extreme peril are many as travelers and explorers set out to lands whose geographies, animal populations, and native citizenry were unknown to them. One narrative, Besieged by Peccaries, written by explorer James W. Wells, tells of a particularly frightening encounter when his camp was attacked by hordes of wild pigs in the far interior of Brazil in 1886. A short time after bedding down, suddenly from all around us came a blood-curdling sound of the simultaneous snapping of teeth with vast numbers of the enemy, followed by the appearance of a crowd of charging black animals rushing with wonderful speed towards a common center, the fort. And further on, the extremely disagreeable and nauseous odors of the animals, their snapping of teeth, like musketry file firing, the reports of the firearms, the shouts of the men, the howling and barking of the dogs, and the dim light created an indescribably strange and exciting scene. This modern-day reader couldn't help visualize the whole scene and several ensuing attacks by other peccary herds as some sort of modern-day horror film, or maybe the next Indiana Jones? In another riveting account of danger, Viennese world traveler and explorer Ida Pfeiffer writes, circa 1851, from Petropolis, north of Rio de Janeiro, "We had no arms, as we had been told that the road was perfectly safe, and the only weapons of defense which we possessed were our parasols. If I except a Claff's knife, which I instantly drew out of my pocket and opened, fully determined to sell my life as dearly as possible." She goes on to describe an attack on the road by a native. Mrs. Pfeiffer's naming and descriptions of local peoples and their characteristics are truly appalling. A rescue and dinner of roasted ape and parrot. A trip to India is similarly hair-raising. Pfeiffer meets a party of hunters riding on elephants, tags along with them. She is given her own hunting knife at this time. And then comes near a lair of tigers. Shot followed shot. The elephants defended their trunks with great dexterity by throwing them up or drawing them in. After a sharp contest of half an hour, we were the victors, and the dead animals were triumphantly stripped of their beautiful skins. Yikes! Nearly all of these travel narratives read like fiction to a modern-day reader. Stories of danger, lost civilizations, exploration, unusual flora and fauna, newly discovered topography, ships lost at sea. But one in particular spoke to my writerly sensibilities and prompted me to immediately write a short story. The 1885 account, The White and Pink Terraces of New Zealand, by historian James Anthony Froude, gripped me for several reasons. First, the sheer poetry of the title had a cadence and visual element that drew me in. Then the fact that this unusual geologic formation was once considered to be the eighth wonder of the world, but was obliterated in a volcanic explosion that removed every trace of it in 1886. Add to that the inclusion in the story of two female Maori guides, and there was a story. What could be more intriguing to the traveler and the writer? A wonder of the world that simply vanished, although they say that if you stand at the edge of Lake Rotomahana and gaze into its depths, you can see a rosy pink reflection, stair-like in appearance, spreading downward as far as the eye can see under the rippling surface of the water. And by the way, our author is based in Lake Forest, Illinois, and she has a website, KathyStevenson.com. That's KathyStevenson.com. That's going to do it for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.